Hi, my name is Genesis Gordon. I'm with Valley Stewardship Network, and today we have Travis Klinkner on to talk about his dairy operation and conservation practices that he does on his farm. Welcome, Travis.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So,
excited to be here.
Yeah, we're glad to have you.
Oh.
So let's just get to know a little bit about you and what you do on your farm. Can you describe your operation? How many cows you milk? How many acres do you farm?
Yeah. So we're an organic dairy. We milk 60 cows organically. We raise all of our own feeds for our livestock. We also raise our young stock. So with those 60 milking cows, we have about 70 other animals, young stock and dry cows, that are the replacement animals and things like that. So at any given time, we've got anywhere between 130, 140 head on our farm at a time that we're managing. But it's only 60 of them that we're getting the milk from. My wife and I purchased the farm from her dad and her uncle back in 2015, so we just celebrated our 10-year anniversary here
this month.
Thank you. Yeah, that's kind of a neat, exciting thing for us. Let's just say that in the last 10 years, a lot has happened. The dynamics of the ag industry are a lot different from what they were 10 years ago, and so that's kind of changed. We're in different places than where I thought we would have been, in good and bad ways. We raise all of our crops, so we rent not quite half of the land that we use for cropland and stuff like that from nearby neighbors and stuff like that. So, and we have a lot of woodland. The farm that we purchased was about over 50% woodland, and what I'm learning here as of late is that a lot of it was actually pasture back in the day, but due to various reasons, changes in landscape and design, I think some of the contour practices and different things like that. And as my farm that we own was actually three different farms at one time. Yeah, as that changed what land was used for pasture or not. But I'm actually looking to, and we can maybe get into this later, but taking some of that land back and putting it into pasture, integrating silvopasture, which is a practice we actually just started last year on our farm. Genesis, you came out and helped plant some of those trees. So for those that don't know, silvo is the study of trees. And pasture is pretty self-explanatory. It's where we graze our animals. And we incorporated trees into our pasture. I think one of the big misconceptions about silvopasture is it's just running cattle in the woods, which we all know can be a very terrible, devastating thing. Back in the 30s, you know, when we ran into so many of the conservation issues that we did, farmers were just grazing everything. It destroyed the woodlands. But they weren't being intentional about it. They were just cattle were in there all the time, or sheep or goats, and they just mowed everything down to nothing, never allowed anything to grow back. Through our silvopasture practices, we're rotationally grazing it, so we're giving rest periods. And true silvopasture is making sure that there is enough sunlight to reach the floor so that grasses and forbs can take off. It's not going to look like your traditional woods. You're just incorporating trees into more of a pasture environment. I think one of the interesting things, most people that know me, when I first took over the farm, the first thing I did was like got rid of all the trees in our pastures because everywhere that there was a tree, there was a ditch, because the cattle would congregate underneath the tree, and then it would rain and everything like that, which it does every year. And the cattle would congregate underneath there, and they would create a mud spot, and then it would just eventually turn into a ditch. Well, what I've learned is there weren't enough trees to disperse the cattle so that they weren't all congregated under a select few trees. The pastures weren't being rotated often enough to allow things to green back up. So we worked with the Savannah Institute to help design a plan. We also worked with our local NRCS office to help fund the plan. And we then created a plan that we'd have enough trees to provide shade for our livestock, but then also leave enough open light so that we could get the grasses and things growing. And so the reason I did it was back in, was it 22 was so dry? Yes, 22 was a dry year. So my livestock, my heifers didn't have any grass to eat, and they're pretty, they're very dependent on grass in my management system. We graze all of our livestock, but we do supplement the milking cows. But the heifers are pretty much 100% pasture. But we, when there wasn't pasture, we had to supplement feed them, so they're coming up to the buildings, and they were just creating a mess. And I just thought it was poor for their health. And I thought, what if? And they were coming for shade and to cool off. So I thought, what if I would have trees out there, enough trees that they could have shade, be out there, healthier, cleaner environment, we could rotate it. So I started investigating this silvopasture idea, and I was like, well, I guess I'm going to have to change my statement of I'll never have trees in my pasture when I decide to plant 500 of them. So yeah, we're really excited about that. We're only year two into that, but I'm kind of excited for that. And it's led me to think, too, what other ways my woodlands are not... I'm a farmer, dairy farmer, and like the payback on woodland is very minimal unless you're enjoying it for recreation, which I can enjoy, or for deer hunting, but like I really don't want any deer because they eat all my crops. But with that being said, I do enjoy the wildlife, but I'm looking at what ways could I maximize the efficiency of the productive life of those acres. And I think diversifying my farm, incorporating more livestock on the land. I also think it could add potential additional conservation measures by allowing us to capture more of the rain that's entering into my woodlands, create some filtration zones so that we could incorporate more water. So I went off on a really long tangent there.
That stuff is all so fascinating. I'm glad you did. And you answered some questions I have, but I also now have come up with some more. I'm really curious to know, in managing dairy cows rotationally, is there a huge difference in management or additional struggles that you might encounter in comparison to rotating for beef production? Like, you have to milk every day, right? So how does that come into a rotational system?
Yes, that's a very good question, and a very big when designing a plan for your rotational grazing. It looks very different from a dairy standpoint versus a beef operation, because you do have to bring these animals in once or twice a day to be milked, depending on how often you're having them out there. Whereas a beef operation, they never have to make it back to the buildings. You can just move from one paddock to the next paddock without having these lanes that these cattle are traveling back and forth on. So that was one of the big things that we did our second year, was we put in cattle lanes. We ripped out every single fence post on the farm, every single fence, and we put them all in new and restructured all the paddocks. We went from like three different paddocks to we now have 18 paddocks for the milking herd, and eight paddocks for the heifers.
Wow.
So yeah, that changed things overnight, but yeah, you definitely have to change it, and you're managing it differently from a beef operation versus a dairy operation. Dairy operations, we're looking for higher protein, higher energy levels. So we're, at least in my operation, we are trying to take things fairly at a more quicker pace rotationally. Whereas some beef operations maybe would have a longer window of like 35, 40 days potentially. Not all. It all depends on what you're managing for and what kind of livestock you've got going on there. But at least from a dairy standpoint, the milking herd is very different than how we manage the heifers and the dry cows and their dairy rotation. So yeah, the milking herd is getting a new paddock every time they go out. So during parts of the year when they go out morning and night, they're getting a new paddock or part of a paddock morning and night, so that they always have something fresh, something, you know, that's going to have a higher protein, higher energy level to it, versus the dry cows will actually let things mature more, progressively, because that balances their diet out better.
Interesting. It sounds like a lot of complexity that you have to remember. Your record keeping must be intense.
Yeah, well, in some ways just doing it is simple, but yeah, the record keeping adds another dimension to it to make sure that, you know, for the organic side of things, we do have to maintain these records for that. But it is also beneficial because I'm pretty good at, like, well, we went through these paddocks, I guess it's now time to start going through again, because I've got them spaced out so I know when we'll be coming back that it's going to be roughly 25, 28 days when we hit it, maybe 30 days at the longest. But yeah, we do have to keep track of it. And I mean, there's times that in the spring of the year, some of these pastures are growing so quick, we'll actually let some pastures just go because we're not going to get to it quick enough, and we'll come back, you know, on a shorter trip around. And it's really an art. Grazing is an art. There's science to it, but it's very much an art. And, you know, and so much of it, the weather plays a big factor in it. You know, cattle eat differently when it rains, after it rains, before it rains, when they go out. If they go out and it starts raining, they all come back to the buildings. And then you hope it stops raining and they'll go back out. If it doesn't stop raining by like midnight, they may stay up all night. So then now your cows are, you know, you've got animal behavior in and amongst all the art of this, which is just like, well, it's pretty simple. Like, we have a crop out there, it needs to be harvested. Well, it's up to the animal to go out and harvest it and whether she feels like doing it. And just like you or I, there are days where we're like, nah. But, you know, when push comes to shove and you're hungry, I guess you'll go out there. But yeah.
Interesting. You mentioned that there are some variables that you need to take into consideration when you're organic. What drove your decision to go organic? What's good or bad about doing organic dairy farming from a business perspective?
So my in-laws and his brother were already organic, which made that decision really easy. I grew up on an organic dairy farm over by Cashton. Our farm now is between Viroqua and Genoa. So I was very familiar with the organic side of things. I feel like even though there's a lot of instability in all dairy markets right now, on the organic side of things, we're offered a contracted price throughout the year. So there's a little bit more consistency knowing what to expect from your paycheck. We have some additional expenses that organic or conventional farmers may not have. So I don't know. I felt like from a financial standpoint, it made more sense that way. From a second standpoint, I've always felt, and I don't want to knock any conventional farmers out there, there's exceptional conventional dairy farms out there doing tremendous work, great stewards of the land and everything like that. But everything that we do in the organic system, I can feel confident that I'm not doing anything harming honeybees. We're working as much with nature as we possibly can. We don't have any other option. We have to do that. Some of the downfalls are is we don't have as many tools in our toolbox, just because we're limited. There's homeopathic approaches, which is what we usually will try when livestock get sick or injured. Some of them work really well. They work better than conventional methods. But then there's certain times when a cow just gets a serious injury, you're really limited in what you're able to provide for that animal. That'd be one of the downsides that I see to organic. But it's the nature of the beast. And so in order to market our milk a certain way, we have to follow certain rules and guidelines, and we've found ways to do that and manage around that. So,
interesting. And you're part of Westby Co-op Creamery, aren't you?
Yeah.
What made you decide to become a part of that co-op, and what are the benefits of being in a co-op?
Yeah, so my dad, he belonged to the co-op. I really appreciate Westby Co-op. We are a small co-op, and we are very much member-owned. All co-ops are member-owned, but with that being said, there's a number of co-ops today that are hundreds if not thousands of farmers, and CEOs are hired to manage these co-ops and often dictate and influence the board of directors, which are farmers, on how to operate the co-op. And I mean, I'll be honest, you know, I know a lot of our board of directors for Westby Creamery. All of us became farmers not to become board of directors. We became dairy farmers because we enjoy working with the livestock, working with the land. But at the end of the day, somebody has to step up to the plate and, you know, help manage this for everybody. And so there's a lot of learning curves to that and a lot of decisions that we as farmers would just rather not worry about. We'd just rather make milk and then watch it miraculously disappear into the hands of all the consumers around us. But the reality is we've got to manage what's in between there. So, yeah, the benefit of a co-op is that you as a farmer have a say in how that enterprise is run, how your milk is marketed, what it's done for. I think Westby Creamery is very unique in that we have a very small number of farms. I couldn't get you right off the bat, but I believe it's under 200 farmers make up Westby Co-op Creamery. Because of our size, we can also be nimble. We can meet certain demands within the market that large corporation, large co-ops cannot make. So we have some flexibility with our nimbleness, but at the end of the day, too, you're one of the smaller fish in the pond. So it can provide other challenges that way. But I just really like Westby Creamery's approach. They're very much in favor of the farmer, for the farmer, and do the best that they can for the farmer. So, and I feel like within that co-op, my voice is heard, not just because I'm loud.
That's fantastic. What does a farmer do if he's not a part of a co-op? What do they do with their milk?
So if you're not part of a co-op, chances are you're going to be selling to a private entity. So just instead of a group of farmers that own the business that's marketing the milk, you're going to sell it to a company that markets your milk. There's pros and cons to that. Then you don't have to worry about making decisions. You're giving all that responsibility to that company to market your milk for you, but you no longer have a say. Some farmers ran into an issue in 2020 during the whole COVID crisis. Some of those private companies, they could drop you if they didn't have a place to go with your milk. They could put bigger limits on you, whereas co-ops kind of have a built-in protection system where the farmers are like, no, wait, we're going to take care of ourselves here. We're going to find a way to make this work. Whereas corporations, they can make whatever decisions you want. But with that being said, corporations need dairy farmers. So they usually are looking out for the farmer's best interest too, because if they get a reputation of not taking care of their farmers, nobody's going to ship their milk to them. So, but yeah, right now, those are kind of really your only options is to find someone to market your milk in Wisconsin, unless you're going to put in your own grade A creamery and do all the work yourself.
Well, that sounds like it would be an incredible amount of work on top of everything you're already doing.
Yes, it is. It takes special, unique individuals to do that.
So as part of the Westby Co-op Creamery, does your milk always go for one purpose? Like, for example, you know your milk is always going for cottage cheese or cream or sour cream, or does it change depending on what the co-op needs to produce?
It's going to change on what the co-op needs to produce. Westby Co-op Creamery is, like, I believe they're one of the only, if not the only, cottage cheese producer in the state of Wisconsin. So we actually will label for multiple different companies. We'll make different batches and things like that, so it'll taste different than like the Westby Creamery cottage cheese. But we have all the equipment to do that. There's just some places that, for whatever reason, they're just not as good at doing that. And there's things that we're not as good at producing as other places. So we'll actually, some of our products we'll have made at other plants. And put the Westby label on it too, just because it's what you're good at, you do, and what you're not good at, don't do. It's good for the bottom line. But yeah, sour cream, yogurts, yeah, those are some things that Westby Creamery is doing. Westby Creamery has never been into the fluid milk market, at least not yet. I know there's a number of us farmers that think that would be really cool, but you know, but it comes down to a numbers and cents game. You know, is that really going to pay off? Is that really where the margins are going to make the most benefit to our farmers? And right now, it isn't showing that. So,
well, the benefit to the farmer should be the priority, in my opinion.
Yep. So, yeah.
Do these products, do they change characteristics, excuse me, throughout the year? For example, does your milk and the products it produces in February differ from July?
Yeah, so there's a couple factors that'll play into that. On the organic side, very much so. excuse me. When you get into the grazing season, your milk is going to taste differently when you get into grasses, fresh cut grasses and things like that. So versus farms that aren't doing as much grazing, they maybe won't see as much of a difference that way. But you also have factors like stored feeds, having different fermentation levels and actually providing higher butter fat and protein content versus other times of the year. Heat stress can play a factor on milk quality and the different components, your protein and butter fat. So yeah, you can get a wide range of things. We as dairy farmers are doing as much as we can to keep as much of that as consistent as we can. Cows are not creatures of change, they're creatures of habit. So a lot of what we're trying to do on a day-to-day basis is create as much consistency in their life as we possibly can, which rotationally grazing is a challenge for that because you are putting them somewhere different every single day, every single time, and the weather's different every single day. And so, yeah, that creates that much more artistically. You know, for myself and a number of farmers that I know, this is typically January and February, sometimes into March, are sometimes our best months because we're feeding all stored feeds. It's the most consistent their diet is because there's no outside influences, you know, because we have them very contained, you know. So it makes it easier to make milk in that kind of environment, which is why some of these large confinement herds are more efficient at producing milk than some of these other herds, like organic farmers who are making all these changes, you know, as part of their rules and regulations. It can take away from some of the production and some of the actual benefits, you know, because we're changing the cow's, you know, behavior and environment on a regular basis. Whereas if you can create as much consistency, you actually have a healthier animal producing things. So, you know, that's a pro and a con to the organic and conventional side of things. So,
wow, a lot to consider.
Yes.
I'm curious to bring the focus back to the farm. What techniques do you use for improving your farm soil and reducing runoff and erosion?
Oh, wow. That's a loaded question with a lot of, not from like a loaded question, but with a lot of answers. We really try to manage our crop rotation so that we can best utilize the manure as a fertilizer source from our farm to build as much additives as we possibly can. Where we're lacking, we can purchase inputs that meet organic standards to build levels up that way. We're also within our rotation thinking of, on the organic side, weed management and row crops can be a challenge. And so you at some point are going to rely on tillage. We've tried to change the way we till to not just be recreational, but rather intentional. You know, not just hooking up the plow and plowing because this feels good. I'm burning diesel today. This is fun. But to be like, what's the least amount of disturbance I have to do, but get the most of what I need to accomplish by removing whatever unwanted plants and pests that I need, and burning the least amount of fuel. I mean, that saves me money by burning less fuel. So we've changed our rotation to use some more less disruptive tillage and we're always using cover crops, you know, in the mix. And we're trying to turn down, whenever we're doing a disturbance to the soil, we're trying to, on my operation, be incorporating some type of green crop. So that what I'm finding and what I'm learning from research is that when we're doing that, we're feeding the biology to recover from the disturbance of the soil. Because in the end, tillage is bad. You know, I'll come out and say that, like, over-tillage is by all means a bad thing. But sometimes it's necessary. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's one of the only options we have. And in organic systems, it's quite frequent that it's the only option we have. So I guess I'm trying to do as many things as I can to offset the damage that tillage could possibly do to soil structure, soil biology. And what I'm finding is when I'm incorporating a green crop, a living plant structure into the soil, that we can help that soil recover much faster, and we don't see the negative benefits so abruptly mm-hmm. from that tillage.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I've heard this saying, roots in the ground hold the soil down, so I'm sure just planting those cover crops really helps hold it in place if you get big rain or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, we've done some infiltration studies, some field days that we had, and yeah, we were seeing that we were getting adequate infiltration rates in rain events, based even though we're doing some things that go against all rules in the book. Yeah.
That's fantastic. Thank you for doing all this awesome stuff. We are wrapping up in time here, but I just want to ask you one more question. What, from your perspective, can a regular consumer like myself do to help dairy farmers?
Wow, that's a really good question. One, consume as many dairy products as possible. Can never have enough butter. You can never have enough cheese, ice cream.
I agree entirely.
Milk with every meal. Yeah, I mean, with that being said, like that, yeah, just supporting your local dairies, purchasing from your local co-ops, that's a benefit. I think one thing I've seen is beneficial through getting to know the people at Valley Stewardship Network, those people that support Valley Stewardship Network. Valley Stewardship Network is doing a lot to work with farmers. And they've been helping me out. Some of the practices we've been doing, Dave has been out to help do some prairie plantings, and he can help fund some of those projects. Because some of these things that we're doing don't really have a quick return on investment back to the farmer, if maybe ever. You know, they will at some point, but it may be more long-term. And so to get some financial help that way, and things that VSN is doing is helping farmers implement some of these things, trying to help break the burden of financial cost to that. So I think supporting organizations like that are helpful, and not being afraid to reach out to a farmer and just communicate with them. The one thing I see so much from the consumer is the disconnect of what really is going on a dairy farm. They'll look from the roadside and see something and make an assumption, and oftentimes, I'll be honest, are probably way off base. Some of the farms that you think are the worst are probably doing the best.
Interesting.
You know, in a lot of ways.
Well, this has been really incredible talking to you, Travis. As usual, you're a wealth of knowledge and also an inspiration in the regenerative agriculture world. Thank you for coming on and for everything you do.
Thank you for having me.